Nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, a very pleasant good day to you. Good morning. It is the 17th of May. This is Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. We have an interface kind of issue with my camera on the but we think it's going to be back up and streaming tomorrow, so I'll be on camera, not that you need to see me. It is the information, but, you know, people like to watch stuff. Dr. Ray Pete is with us this morning. He's a good one. He's been around the bend a very long time when you talk about his work going all the way back to 68 when I was doing Armed Forces Radio. Wow, 68, 50, over 50 years ago, and he was working with hormones and physiological chemistry and physics in 71 and 72. His PhD dissertation, University of Oregon in 72, and he outlined his ideas regarding progesterone and the hormone closely related to it as protection of the body's structure and energy against harmful effects of estrogen, radiation, stress, and lack of oxygen. We've had several people on the air, and Dr. Pete is one, including Dr. Wong, I think, last week, that says a little bit of progesterone. Hearing again is kind of good for you, and I think Dr. Pete developed a product some years ago. I think it's called Progestese. We'll ask him and say hello. Well, good morning, Dr. Pete. How are you, sir?
Good morning. Very, very well.
Yeah. Well, you're sounding good anyway. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of progesterone is good for us all every day.
After I had studied it in the lab, I remembered that every time I handled it, I would stop having hangnails. and ever since I worked in the lab using it, I've never had a hangnail. Those little inflamed red broken places that where the skin sort of splits open. And that started me thinking about how what other things it might do in those very trace amounts. It was probably 3 or 4 years after I did my dissertation that I came across a woman who had what seemed to be a degenerative brain disease. They weren't sure whether it was optic neuritis or a deeper type of brain disease, but she somehow got the idea of progesterone being involved, I think, because of her cyclic symptoms getting worse. And she had been so bad that she was bedridden for 6 months at a time and never could, for 2 or 3 years, couldn't function properly. She needed a walker or would tend to get lost if she trying to go shopping. But she convinced a doctor to give her progesterone shots. That was 1975 or 6. And she started recovering just with a couple of the injections.
My goodness.
She kept convincing different doctors to keep giving it to her, and she recovered so completely that I asked her to do a talk to my endocrine class at the naturopathic medical school. And it was in an old building 2 or 3 stories up. So she had to drive through the city, find a parking place, and walk up 2 or 3 flights of stairs, and then she lectured the whole hour of the class, very well organized, extremely well informed, and she had supposedly had a degenerative brain condition.
Interesting. Wow. So would you say, looking back on this, Dr. Ray Pete, it wasn't necessarily a lack of progesterone that caused it, but the giving the progesterone will help the symptoms to go away? How would you explain it?
Yeah, it stops the stress and puts the cells in a higher energy state of rest, simply letting things catch up, so that even if the original problem was, for example, radiation or poisoning or a vitamin deficiency or mineral deficiency, just by giving this rest period, whatever it was that was going wrong, the body could reorganize itself, catch up, accumulate some of the missing nutrients and so on, and become more efficient.
So rest, so it's actually helping the cells just to settle down and be more parasympathetic?
Neither sympathetic or nor parasympathetic, just in a state of readiness. And you don't need to resort to either of those pushers,
the up or down push.
The cell, it's sort of like a political autonomy. You don't have to be pushed this way or that way when the cells are really highly energized and efficient. They can take care of themselves pretty much and can cooperate efficiently rather than having to be bullied into becoming more active or for more quiescent for sleeping and so on.
Are there things that we do or don't do in the diet arena that occurs the idea that we need to take a little bit of progesterone? Are we missing something?
Just about anything we miss. The strange thing about progesterone is that it literally is good for everything. And that's the trouble of getting someone to understand how useful it can be, is because of the belief that everything has a particular cause and a particular cure. But in the case of a few things, such as progesterone, it's a matter of stabilizing the cell or the organism in its resting state, letting it gather up its forces to go back and work on the particular problems.
Well, it sounds like a real, natural approach. I mean, you're not trying to kill anything or change anything, right? You're just helping the body to heal.
Exactly. It doesn't worry about killing germs or viruses or cancer cells.
Yeah.
In the case of cancer cells, when you can, for example, a skin cancer, I've seen people with diagnosed cancers on their lips or their ears, which they didn't want cut off or irradiated just because they were conspicuous.
Yeah.
And just in a week or so, the thing would either close up, stop being a sore, or would fall off.
Interesting. Wow. Now, you developed a product called Digest Ease, and people can Google that and get it, right? Is it that right? Progest Ease. And there's other one. Other people are using like a wild yam. Is yours a wild yam derivative, the one that you developed?
That was about 70 years ago.
Yeah.
They were making it from wild yams in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And I used to go to school right by the Syntex factory, and that got me curious. In the 1950s, they were already producing that and other hormones, but I didn't start working with it until more than 10 years after that.
Uh-huh. But the Progest Ease is a yam derivative product?
It's the now they use whatever sources economical. It just happens that the the wild yam was a very abundant, cheap source. They could just go in the jungle and pull out these gigantic yams that were sometimes 20 or 30 pounds each.
But does the body really care that the source, as long as it gets...
No, it's all, it goes through more than 20 chemical processes anyway, so it doesn't matter where it came from.
You know, it's really interesting with talking to you all this time, I really appreciate it, that you're not, you've never been really dogmatic against some different pharmaceuticals if they do the job. Is that accurate?
Right, yeah.
Because some of them do something, right? Some of them.
Antibiotics, after all, usually started with a natural substance. There are antibiotics in mushrooms as well as molds and in trees and fruits and so on. Antibiotics are everywhere, so the idea that an antibiotic has to be a harmful drug is a misperception. The problem is that the drug companies are always wanting something more profitable, and so they discourage the use of the simple, abundant, safe materials and add a chlorine or fluorine atom to it and change its behavior and patent it and then promote it as the latest thing that is so good you should forget using the old antibiotics. But what they do is generally make it riskier, even though more powerful in some ways, they're also more harmful in some ways.
Yeah. There's a whole cadre of people, as you know, the Kaufmans and Cowans of the world, and lots of them, Lankas in Germany, that are suggesting that even bacteria, like in the throat, the strep throat, the bacteria is trying to do its thing, and to use an antibiotic for that is just stopping the healing process. Does that resonate with you?
Basically, you should make the organism so healthy and happy that it makes its bacteria healthy and happy.
Mm-hmm.
But if you happen to have a rapidly growing bacteria in your throat that's hurting, a quick swish, rinsing an antibiotic over it can knock it out and give your body a chance to come back and keep it under control.
Oh, in other words, let's see, because they're arguing that the bacteria is really doing the healing, that if you kill it, then you're just stuffing it somewhere else. But you're saying an antibiotic can actually not kill it all and just leave enough?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there have been several studies going back decades in which once they identified that there was a harmful infection,
mm-hmm.
They would give a minimal dose of the antibiotic and watch the symptoms. Usually about a third to a half of the typically prescribed dose would get it under control quickly without hurting the body's immune system.
Interesting. Wow.
And so the total dose, instead of continuing it for 2 weeks, as soon as they would see the symptoms subsiding, maybe in a few hours, or maybe a day or a day and a half.
Interesting.
Well, as soon as the symptoms were gone, they would stop killing the bacteria and let the body's immune system take over again.
Wow, that's pretty cool. And when was this? When did they do this? They figured this out?
I was reading those papers in the 1980s.
I'll be. Boy, you don't hear much of that going around today, do you? Shoo.
No.
Nobody talks about that. All they do is tell you to what? Take 3 weeks and use them all, right? Don't stop. Just keep taking them.
Yeah, that's what gets people in trouble. They knock out the bacteria totally, and then all of those remaining two weeks, what they're doing is weakening the body, because these things are actually directly toxic to our own mitochondria, and ribosomes and various essential processes. They're more toxic to the bacteria, but they're still somewhat toxic. And so if you keep taking massive amounts of them, all you're doing is poisoning yourself a little more unnecessarily.
Mm-hmm. So on the argument that if you do that and do the full course and you do what you just explained, does the initial insult on the body, is it still there? Does it drive it deeper or whatever it is, some kind of poisoning or heavy metal or something?
If you continue the antibiotic just a little beyond the disappearance of the symptoms, just taper off so that you are seeing that the thing isn't ready to have a great resurgence. And if it stays away when you've tapered off, then what you're doing is letting the body's natural immunity start to come back and take over and not let the bacteria set up business again.
And then if you go the other way and just really carpet bomb the whole thing, I guess I'm trying to understand, is there something that's still left in the body that can come back?
Yeah, their idea is that the spores will be there potentially to burst out again. The bacteria defend themselves and go into a spore state where they can resist a moderate amount of the antibiotic. And so the idea is that you have to wait a certain, usually 2 weeks, in some cases 3 weeks of constant bombardment so that you get the last trace of it. It's like cancer therapy, in which first you do surgery and then you use chemical poisons and then irradiate the body for good measure.
Wow.
It's an obsessive belief that the body is absolutely incapable of taking over at some point.
Hmm. So do you think there could be some judicious, really good positive ways of using chemo if you really were
exactly
careful?
Yeah, right at the same time I was reading those antibiotic studies, people were doing the same, advocating about a half to a third or a fourth of the
wow.
potency of the chemotherapy and watching what's happening to the tumor.
Yeah.
And it's a matter of the balance between your body and the tumor. And if you see the tumor shrinking, you don't want to hurt the body any more than necessary. They were having good results with simply trying to shift the balance in favor of the patient and against the tumor without obsessively trying to kill every last imagined cell.
Yeah.
And in fact, that idea of the cancer being a matter of a seed, one evil cell that multiplies and becomes the cancer, that whole thing has never been a valid theory of cancer. The cancer is always involving the restorative healing processes of the organism being weakened. And it's always a matter of a gradation within a field of tissue organization and health.
So the organism just doesn't get strong enough, and then people get consumed by it, and then they die, quote, of cancer, unquote.
Just the last 10 years or so, the standard treatments are demonstrating that when you cut out a tumor otherwise kill it or irradiate it to death, what you left is a wounded area of the organism. And almost always that bad area is going to eventually produce more tumors if you haven't healed the body itself.
Wow.
the signal from a tumor it goes out and recruits cells from the bone marrow and from its immediate neighborhood. These signals of injury are a part of the normal healing process, and in a healthy person, the injury recruits healthy volunteers and does a thorough job of repairing the injury. And the cancer process is just a failed process of healing.
Failed in what way?
The organism can't provide the energy or materials necessary to do a perfect healing job. And so some sickness or inflammation remains in that area. For example, any injury among the signals that it's causing is estrogen. Irritation or lack of oxygen or any stress activates the aromatase enzyme, making estrogen, and the estrogen stimulates cell multiplication and amplifies the inflammation. And if the body can't produce massive amounts of the quieting substances, including progesterone, which should come in and turn off the production of estrogen, then the tumor is able to keep growing as a wound that can't heal.
So then anybody with this thing called cancer, they would do everything they can to stay off of high estrogenic foods would be one thing?
That's helpful. Mm-hmm. But the injured tissue becomes such a powerful source of estrogen that the wow. important thing is to do everything possible to reduce the local production of estrogen. Even in the precancerous state, like in a ductal carcinoma in situ in the breast, or that's a familiar place that doesn't look like cancer at the beginning, but it does tend over the years to develop into a cancer, and even at the earliest stages of that, just because the tissue is irritated, you can see the appearance of aromatase locally producing estrogen right there at the seat of the irritation or the failure to heal properly. And so everything of the organism should be directed to restoring the energy so it stops making the estrogen locally. The concentration of estrogen at an irritated site like that is internally, the source is so intense locally that what happens in your diet or in the system in general, that estrogen is relatively mild and ineffective compared to what's produced locally.
Hmm. So is that one of the reasons why maybe soy and high estrogen foods are generally not best choices in general to eat?
Soy
milk and stuff.
That gives you a background.
Yeah.
Inclined in that direction.
Yeah, yeah. Dr. Pete, stay right there. Dr. Ray Pete is with us, and we're going to dig into your emails. Man, he's fun to talk to, huh? It's great when you have a guy around the house who's studied this stuff. If you'd like to be on the show, we have lots of emails, but we're going to get to as many as we can. Patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. The colostrum is still on sale. I think we have another, maybe a few more days. So check it out, though. No promo code needed. Previously, we asked Dr. Anthony Kleinschmidt, who formulates the colostrum for Surthrival, which is on sale. Is it really anti-aging?
Oh, gosh. You have all of those natural growth factors that are found there, and they've been shown through a lot of research to actually bring you into a younger, more youthful state. And the fun thing about our colostrum through Surthrival is that it's all natural.
There's nothing else added. And you all get this at what time during the whole process of the cows giving birth?
From 0 to 6 to 8 hours after birth. Remember, colostrum is only produced one time, 4 to 6 weeks prior to birth. We take it. We make sure that the calf gets their fill. We take the remainder.
It's really yummy and easy to take. Just warm water or smoothies. It's on sale right now. It is, and it's 20% off, and you don't need a promo code. Just go on Sir Thrival through our website, and I think it's another 3 or 4 days. I'll have to check, but you'll see the sale. So don't wait. If you'd like to get some colostrum, it's just a great product. It's fun. It tastes great. It looks great. The whole everything great. It's great about it. I just love it. You put in your smoothies and rock and roll and just have some fun. Hold on a second here. Let me do this. Okay. And I should know exactly when it's, but I'll check it out. Oops.
Okay.
I got it. Previously on our show, we talked to the now legendary Dr. Dietrich Klinghardt, and he mentioned sulfur. He's a fan.
The conditions in our world and our environment are changing so dramatically. People need to have a whole host of self-help tools and methods, and I'm very thrilled about your version of MSM. It's a right way to go. You know, sulfur is part of most of the detox enzymes, and the critical part that is right now we have a much, much higher need of healthy sulfur than we had even 10 years ago. And so I followed your work a little bit. You know that you're on the right track with what you are promoting.
Well, Dr. Klinghardt, we've heard from thousands of people over the year how they really love this product. You can click and order our Pure Sulfur, three prices, United States, Canada, and worldwide, right here, or email me, Patrick, at oneradionetwork.com for a discount for more than £4. Pure Sulfur, one of the few places where you can get this product. oneradionetwork.com. Yeah, just email me. We send out 3, 4, 5, 6, 8 pounds all the time, all over the world. Remember, we have probably the best, what I think is the absolute best and best priced sauna anywhere on the planet right now. You email me and we get it for $1,195. Very low EMFs. You'll sweat. It's the far infrared rays are the real deal. And detoxification, you do it every day, and just do it and make sure you have plenty of water and, you know, your little electrolytes, and you rock and roll. Check it out. Email me if you'd like to get one of these saunas. They're really good.
We are listener-supported, One Radio Network.
We are talking, have the honor to talk to Dr. A. Pete every month on the third Monday of the month on OneRadioNetwork.com. It is RayPete.com. And also, you can get his newsletter like I signed up for, just to RayPete's newsletter at gmail.com, RayPete's newsletter at gmail.com, and you get your newsletter. And that's every few months, right, Dr. Pete? Yeah, pretty cool. You want to jump into some emails? That's going to take you all over the place today. This is from Alice in Alabama. Dear Dr. Pete, I really like radicchio, and it's high in vitamin E and K. Do you think it's good to eat ongoing, radicchio?
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
Huh? Yep.
Here's Sophie. She's in Baltimore. I have two skin tag questions for Dr. Pete. How to get rid of blackheads and how to shrink pores. Are blackheads skin tags?
No. A blackhead is the oily material with some dead cells mixed in with it, and the reason it's typically dark colored is that it has polyunsaturated fats in the skin oil that oxidize and turn dark, and so it's actually stuff that should have been secreted in a liquid form, but with things like a vitamin A deficiency, in which your skin cells become obstructions to the secretion of oils, sometimes a disturbance of your thyroid gland combined with the vitamin A deficiency will create more blockage in the pores. And those, by being stationary edible material, become potential food for bacteria and potential pimple or boil formation. So it's important to find out why you're secreting too much oil and shedding too many keratinized skin cells. And usually a good diet and checking your thyroid level will correct those, and the pores will gradually return to normal size when you're not plugging them up anymore.
So when the kids get these things, blackheads and stuff, it's just going to Burger Doodle and things like that and just bad food and vats and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, probably. Here is Vic. I'm not sure where he is. I have had heart arrhythmias for about 2 weeks now, various patterns, and haven't really changed anything that might cause them. I'm 70, a male, would like to avoid medical and cure myself. What besides magnesium would Dr. Pete recommend to kind of normalize it from Ty? Oh, thank you. No, Ty. Vic.
Progesterone and related steroids, DHEA, progesterone, and pregnenolone are all stabilizers of the heart rhythm and of the blood vessel tone. Those decrease, all of those decrease progressively with aging and usually a declining thyroid after the age of about 40 or 50, the thyroid is becoming less active, less responsive, and so that produces less conversion of cholesterol to these protective steroids. So if your cholesterol is 250 or 300, that means just by increasing thyroid activity, you could produce a lot more of the protective steroids, which have a heart stabilizing and blood vessel.
So these things you mentioned, the DHE and all that, they are in the body makes them when we have enough cholesterol.
Right? Yeah, thyroid, vitamin A, and cholesterol are needed to make the protective steroids, especially DHEA and progesterone have a natural mild digitalis-like action, a strengthening of the heartbeat and rhythm. When your progesterone and DHEA decline because of that intrinsic digitalis-like effect, what remains is the intracellularly produced estrogen, and estrogen has the opposite of the digitalis effect, so that if you imagine the stimulated heart, as it increases the need to pump harder, it also gets a bigger stroke volume. It pumps both harder and faster when it has the natural protective steroids, and estrogen knocks out that ability to respond to a greater need by increasing both velocity and volume of pumping.
Yeah.
And so you get a tendency to sort of collapse into a very weak shock-like pulse momentarily until you can gather up the stabilizing steroids. And one of the effects of estrogen is to also delay the readiness of the heart to beat again. And so the dangerous arrhythmias, it's called a QT prolongation or a slow QT wave. That's just because the estrogen and many other things that interfere with energy production cause the heart to become delayed in its ability to respond to the next beat. And progesterone and DHEA happen to be the QT shorteners. They are more quickly ready to beat again.
So would this give some real, even more, a little bit of credence to more of Cowan's idea that the heart is not necessarily the thing that's pumping everything around the body, that it's all the blood vessels and the Pollard, you know, and the fourth phase of water, and it's the blood vessels, and they're happy, and they're moving things around the body.
All of the veins converge back to the torso and the vena cava, for example. If it goes limp, a large part of the returned blood pools in this big vein in your body before it gets to the heart. So the heart isn't receiving a fair short share of the returning blood, and so it has a weak heartbeat. That's one of the effects of a shift towards estrogen away from DHEA and progesterone. And the tone of the vena cava goes limp, blood pools, and doesn't get to the heart, and so you have a rapid, weak heartbeat. And what you need to do is tighten up your vein wall muscles so that the veins don't simply hold the idle blood, but they squeeze it back into the heart. And when the vena cava pours its blood into the heart, then the heart can have a strong, full beat.
And we strengthen those how?
Avoiding the stress physiology, keeping the energy level up, which means keeping the ratio of progesterone to estrogen high in favor of progesterone dominance.
And then psychological fear, worry, angst, confusion, that can mess with those guys, right? For sure, yeah. Wow. Here's an email for you from, what do you recommend for acid reflux and preventing ulcers? Also, how do I convince my parents who are both diabetic that drinking orange juice and Mexican Coke is actually could be good for them? I tell them it could help reduce the cortisol in my body, but they won't buy it. Okay, so he's got acid reflux and ulcers. What's the first go-to guy for Hussain, Hussaine in Dallas?
I think the first thing is to make sure your intestine is moving along rhythmically. The average American takes about 76 hours for food to move from the mouth to the excretion.
Really?
And in Africa, in some areas, they've timed it on an average of 12 hours. A very vigorous intestinal action when you're active and eating fibrous food. And so just increasing the amount of safe fiber in your food can stimulate the intestine and keep peristalsis going in the right direction. When you're very hypothyroid and when your blood sugar falls during the night, that creates a stress signals, a mixture of parasympathetic and sympathetic signals to the intestine, causing the peristalsis rhythm to get deranged. And instead of moving from your mouth to your through your stomach to the intestine,
goes the other way.
It goes the other way.
Wow.
And you get a flow backwards. Many years ago, a gastroenterologist experimented on his medical students by inserting a marker into their rectums, and then the next morning taking a swab of their saliva, and they found that the students who normally woke up with bad breath and a bad-tasting mouth, they found the markers had migrated backwards into their mouth. So it was the habitual intestinal rhythm of a fair percentage of even a very healthy population, like medical students. There was a nocturnal reversal of peristalsis.
So what do we do or take during the middle of the night or before bed to help that nocturnal reversal go the other way where it's supposed to, and then the acid thing will settle down?
Keeping your blood sugar up is the first thing, because the stress of nocturnal hypoglycemia is what excites your intestine in a random way.
Interesting.
It's like a frenzy of activity that goes in all directions.
So is that a call for more, that would be orange juice over, say, milk?
Both milk and orange juice are very helpful, because the calcium in the
settles you down.
Milk has a variety of calming effects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow, pretty fascinating. So that's the real acid reflux thing is what's going on. Things are getting backed up.
Yeah, and behind that, there's most often there's a thyroid deficiency leading to an imbalance of all of the other hormones. But milk and orange juice are, and fiber in the diet are the first aids that will help while you study your thyroid situation.
Ah, interesting. It's the 17th of May. We live here, Patrick Timpone. It's about 18 minutes after noon Central Time. Tom Luongo joins us tomorrow. We're going to talk about everything from Bitcoin to potential new Fed coin to all kinds of things, China, Russia, and he's on it, and he's fun to talk to. This is from Ellen. What does Dr. Pete think of the natural supplementation of NAC, which the FDA is apparently going to make a prescription only?
What is the chemical?
NAC. 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 I'm not sure what that is. And I used to know what that is.
Let me see. Acetylcysteine?
That's right. I think I can Google it here, but I think it's a short term for, let me just put in here NAC so you know what it is. It's nitrocysteine, something like that. I think it's NAC supplements for building stronger immune system. Yeah, N-acetylcysteine, yeah.
That does have protective antioxidant effects, but you have to remember that its a basic molecule is cysteine, and too much cysteine or methionine, the related sulfur amino acid, these are potential excitotoxic, life-shortening amino acids that you don't want to chronically overdose on.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. Here's an interesting one. I have a dad. He's 57, had a blood pressure of about 155 over 95 consistently on waking up. His vitamin D is 50 ng/mL. He started drinking a quart and a half of milk, and his blood pressure rose 175 over 105. He has no digestion problems with the milk. When he stopped drinking the milk, his blood pressure dropped back down to the level. Can Dr. Pete offer any clues to why this could be happening here? Why would milk do that?
If it was a sudden change of diet,
that can do it, right?
Yeah, the stomach just takes a while to adapt to a new food.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very high pressure for early in the morning, and it usually means that they have become dehydrated during the night. If they would start taking their milk or juice at bedtime or during the night to prevent the nocturnal dehydration, you should pretty much stop forming urine during the night. But if your kidneys keep working, then you're going to have dehydrated blood by morning, and that will increase your blood pressure. Even drinking water during the night is helps to prevent the morning high blood pressure.
Interesting. Uh-huh. Here's a question for Dr. Pete from Mike. For those who must be COVID vaccinated, is it helpful to take blood-thinning substances like aspirin or maybe vitamin E to help mitigate blood clotting risk? Would the use of vitamin K be detrimental for those at risk for blood clots?
Vitamin K not only facilitates the production of pro-clotting agents in the liver, but it also is necessary for two very important anti-clotting agents, protein C and S. And so it isn't the clot vitamin, it's the coagulation regulatory vitamin. And the deficiency of protein S and C is going to cause a tendency to spontaneous clotting problems. All of the nutrients with some regulation of the platelets or the clotting system or the blood sugar, all of these things are going to reduce inflammation, protective against the COVID infection itself, or equally protective against the vaccine, because the vaccine is simply giving you the toxic part of the virus. Anything anti-inflammatory is likely to be protective against the vaccine and the COVID infection.
There's some folks that are saying that this injection messes with the shikimate pathway, which has been something that Dr. Seneff has talked about with the glyphosates. Can you explain what the shikimate pathway is?
No, I haven't read about it for a long time.
Long time, yeah. Mm-hmm. Here's an email for you. Spike proteins are supposed to exist in cell membranes, but do cell cell membranes even exist? Is it true, according to PubMed, this person says fluorescent nanoparticles are present? Oh, that's the second part. Yeah, let's do this first part. Do cell membranes even exist?
No, that's that's a long story, but it was something made up in the 1940s, counter all of the relevant evidence. It has simply steamrolled science down, very persistent researcher, Gilbert Ling, over and over kept demonstrating that it's a nonsensical, impossible concept, but still the language is there, and it's in the textbooks and on the internet. This imaginary membrane full of pumps and channels and such. You have to remember that it's a metaphor at best, and a very bad metaphor.
So why is that important to us, knowing that? What does that mean to us with cells?
Partly the idea that the virus can only enter when it has a doorknob like the ACE2 enzyme on the surface of a cell. In fact, it's been demonstrated to have other ways of entering a cell. Partly the idea of a membrane serves industry to convince drug companies or to convince the public that you need some special technology to get a drug into your cell. Uh-huh. But even giant molecules like naked DNA molecules, a huge string of a rigid molecule, if you rub native DNA into your skin, it shows up inside the circulatory system in your lymph nodes and lining of the blood vessels. Identifiable as the type of naked DNA that you rubbed into your skin. And if you put it into a culture dish, it simply falls right into the cell. It doesn't need an invitation. Cells are selectively permeable, but extremely permeable to the right kind of substance. So the idea of a blood-brain barrier, it's partly based on the idea of the barrier membrane, but it really is a matter of the solubility difference between the brain substance and the blood substance. The brain is a big ball of fat, and the blood is watery. And water-soluble things just don't want to dissolve in the brain. It's the same as in the cell. Oily things are taken up by the cells. Similarly, if you put an oily emulsion into your carotid artery, a very large percentage of it is going right into your brain on the first pass through your head.
Whoa.
So that there's no barrier functional to oily substances. It's just a matter of solubility. And that same thing happens on every cell in relation to its environment. It's always selecting things that are more soluble and excluding things that are less soluble.
There are people that are out there, Dr. Pete, suggesting that the glyphosate thing, albeit a problem, could not be as bad as you know, we're being told, because it is a water-soluble thing and it's going to leave the body. Do you think that's true?
Right. It tends to stay out of vitamin E, for example. If you use an oily herbicide or pesticide on your crop, that's going to show up in the oily part of your crop production, such as vitamin E. So actually, as far as glyphosate goes, and glyphosate is very bad because it's poisonous in a variety of ways, but it happens to be excluded from oils, from vegetable oils, and vitamin E and so on, just because it's water soluble.
So is vitamin E then protective against glyphosate?
Not particularly, but you don't have to worry about the source of your olive oil being free of glyphosate, because it doesn't tend to get into oily materials. But it can be on your cotton or your fruit or grains and so on.
So can it be into our conventional orange juice that we love?
I've never heard of it being used around oranges.
Oh, really? Oh, cool. I hope not. It's hard to get organic, you know, orange juice. Man, it's... Mm-hmm. Yeah. Here's an interesting. Is it true, according to PubMed, fluorescent nanoparticles are present in Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola? Fluorescent nanoparticles.
Haven't heard of it. Yeah.
Me neither. It's a new one. Here's one for you. What are normal levels of thyroid for a 26-year-old woman? My older sister did her TSH, T4F, T3 test, and her doctor said that she's fine, but still feeling coldness and numbness in her hands and her feet. Do you have off the top of your head some of the your levels on some of these things?
The thing the thyroid does is make your metabolism run, consume oxygen, and if you aren't consuming oxygen, it's a fairly good chance that you don't have enough thyroid. It's the basic thing that makes us produce heat by consuming oxygen. So no matter whether you have the same amount of those chemicals detected in your blood, if it isn't activating the cells, then you can still be hypothyroid. The TSH number ranges from 0.5 to 5.0, according to many official sources, and that range can cover everything from a very warm, active person to a very sluggish, cold, hypometabolic person, usually up around a TSH of 4, they're almost always suffering from fairly obvious hypothyroid symptoms. So it's a matter of whether you want to please your doctor or whether you want to metabolize energetically.
Uh-huh. All right. This is interesting. Okay. This is from Elena. She says, I am 55 years old, in good health, no issues, but every now and then I get swelling, what is called edema, in my feet, sometimes one, sometimes two. It doesn't last very long, but I want to know the root cause of this, if Dr. Pete can tell me. Why is it doing this? What's that hooked up to? Is it a kidney thing, edema?
Yeah, that's part of it. Sometimes it's a very simple thing in your diet corresponding to your hormones. And at the age of 55, people are still cycling. It doesn't matter that you're not having visible menstrual mm-hmm. cycles, but still the brain and the pituitary tend to cycle. And so lots of women in their 50s will have the typical premenstrual water retention symptoms. Sometimes all that's needed is to salt your food to taste. In pregnancy, they used to restrict sodium so they wouldn't gain weight during pregnancy. The problem was that the high estrogen people, and who were usually low thyroid, weren't able to retain the sodium in their kidneys, and their body fluids became diluted, and the amount of albumin in the blood tends to be lost when you don't have enough sodium to hold the conformation of the albumin molecule proper. Edema goes with loss of sodium and albumin in the urine, and also the entry of albumin and sodium into your tissues with the water. But if you had more sodium available running through your system, that would stabilize the albumin in your bloodstream and attract the water out of your tissues, such as your feet, where it goes by gravity. Circulate the water through your kidneys so that the water could be moved out of your body without losing the combination of sodium and magnesium. Getting the estrogen down makes you able to produce more albumin and to retain more sodium so that the water is properly distributed, pulling it into your bloodstream and carrying it to the liver, to the kidneys.
Hmm. Wow, fascinating. Wow. All these little pieces, parts are all connected up, aren't they, Dr. Pete? Man, we really have to be clever these days to understand these bodies. We appreciate your input on these things. If one was to receive a prostate cancer diagnosis, writes Michael, what would be the best course of action, in your opinion, to prevent it from becoming metastasized? Would use of testosterone, DHT, or progesterone be recommended?
All of those, if you're sure that your thyroid is functioning properly and that you aren't likely to turn your testosterone into estrogen. And aspirin is a very competent way to suppress aromatase and protect your testosterone or DHEA from turning into estrogen.
Bigger old bear aspirin, just a bear aspirin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. More than 20 years ago, doctors started realizing that with the diagnosis of prostate cancer, they had seen the increased diagnosis using the PSA antigen, and following that increased diagnosis, the death rate went up sharply. And as a result of that, the prostate specialist started realizing that not treating diagnosed prostate cancer was usually the best policy. Watchful waiting, they called it, because it can take 20 years or so for a diagnosable prostate cancer to become harmful, and meanwhile you have the opportunity to prevent metastatic spread of it. And aspirin and progesterone and DHT are probably all protective against metastasis.
So would you do like just one of the little bear, what are they, 250, or could you do even baby aspirin, or how much would you take?
Oh, as much as your stomach agrees with.
Really?
Could be 2 or 3 500 milligram tablets per day.
Really? That's a lot. But just so your tummy likes it, okay, because so you eat it with food, you put them with food?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because what does it do to the tummy? It can upset it?
It's only 3 or 4% of the people that have problems, and most of them, if they took enough vitamin K, they wouldn't have the bleeding problems in their stomach.
Vitamin K, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's pretty interesting. Stay right there, Doc. We're going to do a couple little breaks before we go. Dr. Ray Peet, well, that calls for a little plug for Daniel Vitalis's product. He has vitamin D, K2 thing. So if you want to get some vitamin D, K2 thing, you can go to Daniel Vitalis's SirThrival website and get yourself a little K in there. Yeah, and vitamin D. And I like to get out in the sun. I think I have plenty, but sometimes people want to even kind of check it out and test it and all that. But SirThrival's got the colostrum on sale, and they have elk velvet antler and pine pollen, and then the vitamin D, vitamin D3, K2 product. And it's all from very, very nice ingredients, just all kinds of really luscious stuff. No, no chems, nothing like that. Just really cool. So you might want to explore that on OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's our sauna. Previously with Dr. Thomas Rau, the Pericles Medical Clinic in Switzerland. Their specialty is detoxification. We asked him about far infrared saunas.
The far infrared sauna goes much deeper into the skin subcutaneously. It has its maximum about 4 to 5 centimeters below the skin surface.
You've actually measured materials in the sweat, and you've proven this.
Yes, the patients, after a week doing this every day, half an hour or 45 minutes, they react quite much with sweat. Then you can collect this sweat, then you measure this, and then you find how much they detoxify with the heavy metals. It's really amazing.
It really is kind of amazing, isn't it? You actually measure this sweat. It's great. Boy, I love this. It's just, what I like to do is do the sauna, even in the middle of the night if I wake up or something, and then just run and do in a cold shower, and just, man, cold shower. And boy, it's fun. Really, really, really pretty fun. It's only cold for like a few seconds. Previously with Dr. Charles Gant, MD, about sulfur.
I just wanted to say, Patrick, that I heard during the break talking to Dr. Stephanie, I'm a big fan of hers.
Are you really? She's great. This sulfur transferase thing and the glyphosates. Then there's also a genetic predisposition to this as well?
Yes.
Oh. And that could complicate matters too for those on GMO foods, huh?
Exactly. But now that we're in this toxic age with the glyphosate and the massive sulfur deficiencies, and generally I recommend a little MSM, 500 milligrams, one twice a day for just about everybody, just to get some basic organic sulfur on board.
Do you feel like it helps them to get some of this yuck stuff out and clean out the trash?
Well, that's
the whole point. Huh?
Well, I can see that sulfur is a conjugator of toxins. sulfur transferase transfers the sulfur. Sulfur has a love affair with heavy metals and other toxins. So, I mean, I saw that right from the beginning. And so I just assumed that a little bit of sulfur could help just about anybody.
Well, maybe you should take a little every day. You can click and order Pure Sulfur right on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com. Previously, with our friend Brandon Amalani of Shen Blossom.
A good example of this also is like the Hoshuwu formula. That is, that's a new one that came out. It's really good because it's a blood builder. A lot of people don't understand that Hoshuwu is actually toxic if it's not prepared correctly. So I wanted to come out with one that not only features the Hoshuwu as the king herb in the formula, but it's prepared of a minimum of 14 days. Usually we try and get 20, 21 days of cooking it. So you can think of it as like it's in a slow cooker with black beans. And it's basically just cooking down and deactivating some of those liver toxic compounds. So we do use that as like the bulk of the formula, but we basically put a lot of like mature ginseng root, like in our root extract. We have the fermented and hydrolyzed pearl powder, reishi stem, and it's got shudihong, which is like a Romania type family. We got both the prepared warm stuff and then the cool stuff to kind of balance it out in a sense so it doesn't become sticky. If you get a good quality Hoshuwu that's properly prepared, it definitely has some invigorating qualities to it and makes you feel relaxed, but yet fully vigorous and energized.
Now, that's the kind of Hoshuwu that you would like, right? Really nice products, as you can hear. If you'd like to order Hoshuwu or the other products, click on Shen Blossom right there on the front page, OneRadioNetwork.com.
Know the source.
The source.
OneRadioNetwork.com.
Nice way to support Dr. Ray Pete. He does this all for freebies, and I don't think he's probably. You're not selling a lot of your artwork to famous galleries and getting like uber rich, are you? Going to just quit here? Just kidding. You could do Ray Pete's newsletter at gmail.com and support him. It's very inexpensive. And your last one was on the whole thing about dying and chi and energy and everything.
No,
it wasn't. Oh, because I haven't read it yet, but I got it a few days ago. I thought that's what it was about. Oh, that's
what was the title of it?
Something about, because you were saying your newest one was going to be about why we die and the loss of energy and that kind of thing. I thought that's
the other direction, really, the development as the intention of our individual cells and their purposes being sort of the democratic approach to what the whole organism is doing, looking at the parts as full participants in the purpose of the organism. It's a perspective on development and recuperation, as well as the process of aging.
I just signed up. I think I got the first one, I guess, about a week ago. I just haven't read it yet. Cool. But you can do Ray Pete's newsletter at gmail.com. Here's an email for you. Oh, please address how it's possible that orange juice and Mexican Coke could actually help someone with type 2 diabetes?
If you look at the actual mechanisms going on in diabetes, the polyunsaturated fatty acids are the real villain. Looking at the functions of the pancreas itself, the beta cells that make insulin are constantly regenerating. As soon as they regenerate, they are quickly killed by the oxidative damage done by the circulating fatty acids. But the regeneration is supported by glucose. So if you keep your glucose up, you're going to have constantly regenerated beta cells in the pancreas. And the problem is how not to kill them with an excess of fatty acids. And if you look at a population like Israel, the first generation immigrants to Israel from North Africa were free of diabetes. But as soon as they adapted and became fully adjusted and started eating the European diet that was the common standard in Israel, that their diabetes level came right up to the European level. So it was the availability of vegetable oil, polyunsaturated oils, that made them adapt and become diabetic, where they had been completely free of diabetes. And animal experiments, if you make them, starve them for the so-called essential fatty acids until you can't detect a significant amount in their blood, then they, if you poison their pancreas and try to create diabetes, they are extremely resistant. All of these, both the internal mechanism, the individuals demonstrated resistance to becoming diabetic, and the population level, where a whole population adapts, all of these show that it's the polyunsaturated fats, not the carbohydrates, that cause the development of the so-called diabetes problem.
So that's we call them PUFAs. So that would be all oils like canola and Wesson and right, all these oils.
Yeah, right. corn oil, canola, soybean oil. They're all good diabetes manufacturers. Mm.
And it would make sense, Dr. Pete, because I mean, if you look in the foods, I'm sure it's, I would suspect they're all over fast foods, wouldn't they be? And fries and burgers and whatever, right? And then any processed food. I mean, it's hard to find even an organic one that doesn't want to put canola oil in it. I mean, it's everywhere, right?
And it's the same with obesity.
Yeah,
the population is shifting towards an increasingly diabetogenic, obesogenic diet with PUFA.
So these things just weren't made to be put into oils. I mean, they just weren't, right?
Partly they are storing energy for the plants, but they are defensive substances. The plant doesn't want its seed to be consumed for food. They want the seed to produce a new generation of plants. They produce a variety of toxins, special in the seeds, that block digestion. Cows or people eating the seeds don't profit from them very much, because there are things like the polyunsaturated fats that block our ability to digest proteins. And so even though they contain proteins, they contain specific toxins that block animal proteolytic enzymes, not affecting the plant's own enzymes. So it's obvious that they were evolved to damage animal digestion.
Wow. So that's a problem with cows and eating, you know, corn-fed beef and that kind of stuff. It's just a problem.
If they eat grasses, the grass contains enough vitamin E that it is helping to destroy the great 97%, 98% of the PUFA is destroyed in a cow's healthy rumen in the presence of vitamin E. But if there isn't enough vitamin E, it's in grass, then the PUFA in the grains goes right through into the milk.
Wow. Well, I mean, because a lot of the meats are, they call it grain-fed and grass-finished, or the opposite, right? Or grass-fed and grain-finished, so you got to be careful what they're doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. So that's why our best shot is is olive oil. Olive is a fruit, is it not? It's a fruit.
It's a fruit oil, and it is, that means it's full of defensive things. The plant wants the fruit to be eaten without the seed is very hard, and so it passes through the normal situation. You eat the fruit and discard the seed, so the seed is protected, but the fruit is a benefit to the animal, so that the plant benefits by having its seeds propagated by healthy animals.
Interesting. This is from Mary. She said, I know you can't give medical advice and it's tough to do this on a show, but would you mind just giving me some input? She went to the doctor. Everything was fine. The doctor said my levels are great, but I have cold hands and feet and numb, and I'm also having a hard time getting pregnant. She's got a TSH of 2.5, T3 at 3.5, and a T4 at 1.39. Could Dr. Pete give me some advice of what I can do from here? Her doctor says everything's good.
It used to be recognized in the 1940s that thyroid hormone was the fertility hormone, the first basic fertility hormone, both for men and women, supported by progesterone. But the thyroid is the basic thing, and all of the signs of hypothyroidism, cold hands and feet, are basic. Infertility is just one of the standard hypothyroid signs. I've known people who hadn't been able to get pregnant for 10 or 15 years. Within 2 or 3 weeks after correcting their thyroid problem and eating well, they were pregnant.
Wow. So with these numbers, she could maybe experiment with a little bit of thyroid and see if she feels better? And just do you think these numbers warrant her doing that?
I've never seen a person with even as high as 2.0 TSH who didn't have some serious symptoms.
Oh, really? Wow.
If you look like doctors used to, but besides doing tests such as measuring their cholesterol, their carotene, their relaxation, recovery rate of a reflex, and their oxygen consumption, those were clear metabolic functional indicators of rate of metabolism, oxidative metabolism, and therefore thyroid function. They used to effectively diagnose by those indicators. Now, the official policy statements of the medical boards are direct instructions to ignore all of those relevant things. Go only by TSH.
Just go by TSH, and you still like the lower the better, way down there, right?
They accept it all the way up to 5 or so.
But not.
But when you look at a healthy population, people under the level of 0.4 on the TSH test were the healthiest, had no thyroid cancer essentially in that population.
Interesting. So you could just do a TSH and just forget all the other stuff, you know what you're saying, if you want it. If you wanted to do a blood test?
The essential thing is to look at your temperature, your ability to metabolize calories, to eat 2,000 calories a day without gaining weight, and to have all of the normal energy functions that go with thyroid, and to ignore pretty much the blood tests, because you have to know a lot about the organism before you can interpret the blood test.
Right. And so what we've, if I remember, then we want to be just anywhere above 97, let's see, what is it, 97.7 to 98.6 in the morning?
Is that around plus or minus a few tenths, around 98 in the morning. and up to 98.6 is good in the afternoon.
And so if you're below 98 in the morning, might a little thyroid might juice you up a little bit.
Yeah.
And you could start small too, right? Just start small.
Fourth of a grain or 15 milligrams of Armour thyroid, for example, is a good starting point. And that amount used to be pretty close to the average consumed by people on the average diet.
Really?
Throughout history. If you make a chicken soup or fish soup, there was always a thyroid disintegrating in the soup. And so you were always getting some thyroid gland along with your meats.
Mm-hmm. This is great. This is an interesting question. I'm glad we save it for last. Patrick was talking about there are states, we had a show this morning, and there are states wanting to pass a heartbeat kind of a thing. So if there's a heartbeat, then you can't do an abortion. I think they're calling it a heartbeat. And a lot of states are interested in doing this. I'm sure it'll be taken to the Supreme Court. Who cares? But I'm curious what Dr. Pete thinks about this. And when does he think soul enters the body? I love it. That's a great question. That's a good question. Doesn't the Bible talk about soul as the first breath or something? In the first? No?
Yeah, that's one of the meanings of it, is breath, psyche and so on. The newsletter I'm working on right now is looking at all of the cells right from the beginning as containing soul.
So, yeah, it would be everywhere, right? If just every
every bit would contain a soul just as much as the whole, so that you can't sacrifice any part without being responsible for knowing that it's an autonomous awareness.
Yeah, so it's just. We're saturated, the whole body is saturated with who we are, really. And that makes sense, because if we worry or something, it's in our body, isn't it? I mean, it's in there.
Yeah.
So if we abort a fetus at a month, but then soul doesn't die. So, I mean, you are killing something, but you're not. I mean, you know what I mean?
Our personality is constantly developing.
Right.
The things we eat have personalities, and you have to realize that like the Jain religion, their basic principle is harmlessness.
Right.
But when you try to apply harmlessness, you see that you're constantly damaging awarenesses. Even plants have sensations. And
of course, yes, of course. So everybody's killing something in a sense, even though nothing really dies, because, right, what has a beginning has an end, but God really has never had a beginning, has it, he, she?
Yeah, yeah.
He, she, it? Okay. Well, you're always fun to talk to, Dr. Pete. Thanks so much for visiting with us this morning. Dr. Ray Pete's, you can go raypetesnewsletter@gmail.com if you'd like to get on board with that. So that's the one you're working on now. That's the one you're... that's one. I'm looking forward to reading that guy. And, you have a nice time up there in the Northwest. Are you people just still, like, silly and you know, in the streets and whatever they do up there?
People are starting to... come out without their masks.
You're not going to get the vaccination or the jab, are you?
Oh no, okay,
I didn't think you were. I just wanted to, because somebody emailed and wanted to know. Yes, Dr. Pete. Okay, all right, sir, thanks a lot. We love you, and thanks for being here.
Okay, thank you,
sir. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Dr. Ray Pete, Patrick Timpone, he's a good man. He's the real deal, man. Well, what has a beginning has an end, and, you know, it's always fun to think about. We're going to have fun tomorrow. We're going to talk to Tom Luongo. And Tom is quite a curious sort when it comes to the monetary system, central banking, geopolitics, cryptos. He's out of control, and he's great. And so he's going to be here tomorrow at noon. I don't think we'll probably won't have something until noon. I can sleep in, have some orange juice. Mel Kay is going to be here on Thursday. Mel Kay, she's quite a fascinating little gal. And she's in the genre. I don't know if you've ever seen any of the work of Charlie Ward, Simon Parks, Juan O'Savin, Robert David Steele, all these folks. Who's the other one? Sasha Stone. The people that are out there, they're doing a tour now. And so she's in this genre, kind of keeping her eyes on what's going on with the politics, geopolitics, and even the pedophile thing. She's all over that. And, you know, these people claim that there's a whole lot more going on, deep down in the bowels of reality than you and I know about, because nobody reports on it except these people. So it'll be fun. We're going to have her on Thursday. Matthew Arrett will be here on Wednesday. Don DeMello. And Don DeMello, I think it's going to be great. I saw the title of the book, and before I even looked into it, I said, yep, we want to get him on. His book is about don't try to fix it, just get awake. And I know he's on it. I don't know if it's the exact title. Just get awake. And I know he's on it with saying this, because anybody that says this understands that we do not need to fix ourselves. Just get awake and go where we want to go. So there's nothing to fix. It's just the mind. And if you get in there and try to fix the mind, well, then you'll be there all day long and lifetimes trying to fix the mind, which is just software. And it's just trying to go into Windows 10 and start reprogramming it. What's the point? Just ignore it and don't try to fix anything. Just get awake and see who you are, why you are, where you are, and then go where you want to go. That's what we talk about all the time here, because this is the key to it, in my opinion. This idea of fixing something or going to therapy and all that, it's just, this has been going on forever and ever, and, I love these people. I've been going to my therapist for about 25 years. Boy, she's great. Okay? You know what I'm saying. Yeah. No need to fix anything. Just do what you want, and don't do things that you don't want. So, do what you want. Do what makes you happy. Now, you can't, get involved in people's space and their stuff and their, as Richard Mayberry says, do all you have agreed to do and do not encroach on other people or their property. You can't do that. But other than that, you get to do what you want. And, any politician that tells you can't, well, then you just need to join the Libertarian Party or just don't pay attention to them, because they're all bonkers. No politician, no person that have the authority to tell you to do anything. Zero, not nada. Now, private companies can. So if you like going into Costco and getting some of their 2-pound organic black cherry things, organic, which is great, and then they want you to wear a mask, if you want to go in there, well, they just got to do it, because it's a private company, and I don't recommend it, because I don't do it anymore, because I don't even want to put one of those suckers on. But I did for a while, just because I wanted their organic cherries, but I don't care. I'll just pay more somewhere. I don't care. Okay, kids, I love you all very much. Don't mind me. I just drone on here every now and then. I will see you tomorrow with Tom Luongo. Tom Luongo. Let me know if we can help with anything. My email is always 2 or 3 times a day. I check my email, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. patrick@oneradionetwork.com. I love you all very much. You're doing great, no matter what anybody says. May the blessings be.
We are listener-supported, One Radio Network.